Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy, and we will be joined a little bit later on by Long Beach State coach Eric Valenzuela. Very excited to talk with coach about the Dirtbags and his first year on the job there at Long Beach. Here on the Baseball America College Podcast, presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national-database. Hey, Joe. We are into October now, and that means playoff baseball, among other things. It's hard to believe we're in October. I say that every month now during this off season that won't end. But you know, October, I really did sneak up on me. The MLB playoffs really snuck up on me. I mean, obviously those started in September, and I think that was a little bit part of that last week. But it's hard to believe we're into October, and for the programs that are playing fall baseball this year, like they're moving along pretty well into the fall at this point. A lot of them are, you know, kind of approaching completion or at least well into it. Obviously, in some of the absolute best weather, they're just going to get going here a bit. But it's been interesting to watch how everything's played out as we've reached October here.
It is a little bit of an advantage, you know, spoiler alert for our, you know, interview with Coach Valenzuela, or, you know, we don't mention fall practice there with him. That's because they haven't really gotten a chance to get going yet. But, you know, you think about the clock is really ticking, but, you know, Southern California, they've got a little bit of time. It's really just comes down to how soon they're able to get out there. There are a few places that are a little bit that have that going for them. Southern California is one. Another one, of course, is South Florida. And I always know that because Miami typically starts their fall practice very, very late. I remember talking to Gino Damari last fall on this podcast, I think, and we were well into October and they had just started or had maybe were getting ready to start one of the two. So time is on their side. It's just in a lot of places, it's just a matter of will they be able to get out there at some point. So, but yes, I'm with you. It is surprising that we are into October. And I was thinking about this the other day, just the degree to which things that happened, non-college baseball things, because I think we all live so close to college baseball that it's hard for us to really have a warped sense of time when it comes to that kind of thing. However, with non-college baseball things, somebody was referencing Tiger King on Netflix, which is a show I did not watch, but many, many people did back in March and April. And it seems like that was both yesterday and also 2 years ago somehow. So the pandemic has created this weird warping effect of time where time both expands and contracts. And that's how we end up with, hey, look, October is here. So, but it has been nice to get the places that can get out there and play some fall baseball. That has been nice. The teams out here locally where we are mostly underway here, as far as I know. And they're a little bit different rules about, you know, whether or not folks like us can show up and take it in and versus not. But the place I have been able to go, it's been nice. Like we've talked a lot about searching for normalcy and getting out there in the fall a little bit with a little bit of chill in the air and the sunny days has been a nice little piece of normalcy and has me even more excited for the coming season in 2021.
Absolutely. Well, since we pressed stop on last week's episode, we had a bit of college baseball news. Last week, LaSalle came out with an announcement that they are cutting 7 sports, including the baseball program, following this academic year. So the Explorers will play this spring, but after that, the program is to be disbanded. That, you know, brings the total program cut count so far in 2020 up to 4. They joined Furman, Chicago State, Bowling Green was cut, but later, that decision was reversed, and now, also LaSalle joins that list. And unfortunate to see any any program go away, of course, but this one, a part of a much larger cut in the athletic department. In some of these other places, it, you know, Chicago State only cut baseball. Furman, I think it was only cutting two sports. But LaSalle gets caught up in a much larger athletic department restructuring. And we've seen that at some other places. Stanford did it. Brown did it. You know, so George Washington did it. These were places that sponsored a very high number of sports. LaSalle is at 25 right now. They'll go down to 18, which is much closer to the average if you look around the country, and especially at schools in the Atlantic 10. Where LaSalle plays, that's right around average now. And it seemed like they weren't saying it was a result so much of cost-cutting as much as it was LaSalle is no longer thrilled with the idea of being a school that sponsors 25 sports that aren't as competitive as they would like to be, and they would prefer to be a school that sponsors 18 more competitive sports. Not great, no matter how you slice it, for the baseball program. You know, as you know, the players will now all have to find new homes if they want to continue playing. But it is, you know, it just feels a little bit different, I guess, if that's the rationale, at least from the outside, than hearing, you know, from a monetary standpoint. Point they can't figure out how to make it work, but the end result, of course, is the same, and it's not great news for college baseball. As now LaSalle, Boise State, Chicago State, and Furman, you know, after this season, will no longer have programs.
I think you're right that it definitely did seem like a philosophy shift within the LaSalle athletic department versus anything, you know, versus just, you know, strictly cost. Well, cost is obviously part of it, but you know, I think there's a difference between the types of schools that typically have, you know, numbers of sports in the high 20s versus the schools that have sports in the teens. That's not to say you can't succeed in a lot of different sports with a high number. Stanford famously did that for a long, long time. But there tends to be a little bit of a difference in those schools that have those high numbers. It's schools that are like Ivy League schools, private academic institutions, of which LaSalle is one. But, you know, along the Eastern Seaboard, you know, schools like that. And what you see in a lot of those cases are those schools are big on athletics as just part of, you know, total student enrichment. And it's just, you know, they offer all those sports as because they just want those sports to be part of the campus community. And they want the most vibrant, you know, on campus, you know, student life experience they can provide. And athletics are a part of that. Whereas the schools that typically are real serious about being very successful at a small number or slightly larger number of sports tend to not be the schools that have these huge, huge athletic departments from a philosophy standpoint. Again, Stanford bucks that trend. I'm sure there are plenty of others that are very successful in specific sports and sponsor 20 some odd different sports. But this did feel like a shift in philosophy there. And there, you know, LaSalle has, you know, from a baseball standpoint, LaSalle has struggled. It's just a program that has not really been altogether relevant for the most part. Even with schools like Bowling Green, you could point to a couple of famous big leaguers who kind of made their names originally at Bowling Green before moving on to pro baseball. You can't necessarily, there are some players, Tom Filer, who have come through LaSalle to become pro baseball players, but it's certainly not a program that was churning out a lot of pro talent. That said, there are a couple guys on the team, and you know, understanding, of course, that LaSalle was not going to be a challenger, predicted to be a challenger in the A-10 and still likely will not be in 2021 and hasn't been. They've got a couple of players. Tatum Levins is a catcher who's put up big numbers there, who's well thought of, and he's the type of guy, if he doesn't get drafted, he is a junior. This is his third year of eligibility, I should say. I guess he'd be a third-year sophomore, to use the 2021 parlance, but really productive catcher, really highly thought of. He's the type of guy that if he does not get drafted in a place that he sees fit to sign, you know, he's the type of guy that I think there could be a lot of competition over in the transfer portal because he's really, really talented guy, and catchers who can mash are in short order, and he looks the part physically. So, you know, that's a guy to watch. They also have a nice lefty named Colin Scanlon, who is you know, is a senior. So maybe he just kind of moves on, or maybe he goes into pro ball kind of regardless, because he's been on campus a little bit longer than Levin's. But there are a couple players there that, you know, if you're a, you know, if you're a fan of some other program in the region, might provide an opportunity for, you know, your roster to get an influx of talent with those guys if they choose to return to college baseball after the program ends up going by the wayside after the 21 season.
Yeah, that'll certainly be something to track. I believe those players can get eligibility for the spring if they were to transfer immediately. This is a little bit of an unusual time to be cutting a program, but again, LaSalle is cutting far more than baseball here. So kind of in these larger restructurings, the fall is kind of a more traditional time to make a bigger cut like that. Usually we'd see it in the spring, but you know, again, it's an unusual year, and if you're making a, you know, these department-wide changes, those kinds of things tend to come down the pipe just whenever they come down the pipe. So that's something to track, both in terms of the transfer portal, in terms of LaSalle, and just in terms of the 2020 year, the effects this year is having on college athletics and specifically the baseball programs. I believe now with this fourth program getting cut, as a sport, it will be neutral after this season. We added some new teams coming up from Division II this year, and now with four programs going out, or maybe this makes it negative one. I guess this will make it negative one, but then St. Thomas has already declared its intention to reclassify from Division III. So overall, still going to be neutral. We'll see what continues to transpire in this kind of space as colleges continue to grapple with some of the financial realities that the pandemic has wrought. If you're interested in finding out more, there's a little bit more on the website, but just something to track here in the A-10, as this will be LaSalle's final season with baseball program. All right, let's shift gears. Let's get to Long Beach State coach Eric Valenzuela. The Dirtbags were one of 2020's great stories before the season was cut short. They started the year with some really loud series wins against Wake Forest, Cal, and Mississippi State. Just a really impressive start to the season, racing into the top 25 after a couple very disappointing seasons for the Dirtbags. This was Eric Valenzuela's first season, and they were off to just a flying start. And so, I mean, we're already excited to see what he could do with the program. Now, you know, that this just ratcheted that up a little bit further, I think, just seeing what they were able to accomplish so quickly in 2020. Now what they'll be able to do moving forward becomes, you know, even more interesting as they look to compete with the likes of Fullerton and Santa Barbara there at the top of the Big West. So lots to talk about with Eric Valenzuela, and we'll get right into that after a word from my book. It's October, and at MyBookie, that can only mean one thing. It's winning season. Winning season means doubling your first deposit. Winning season means free bets, super contests, Survivor, and more. At MyBookie, winning season is all about your chance to win big. Bet NBA playoffs, Major League Baseball, UFC, NFL, and then some. The craziest sports October of your lifetime is here. It's simple. Make your picks, win big, collect your cash. Invest in your intuition. Select from hundreds of future bets, or you can bet games in real time with MyBookie's live betting. Put that big brain of yours to good use. Use promo code BASEBALLAMERICA, it's all one word, BASEBALLAMERICA, and double your first deposit. New players get up to $1,000 in free play, designed to add more excitement to the sports you love and the games you bet. Thousands of cross-sport wagers, props, and parlays await. Sign up now to bet with the best and celebrate your victory. Your winning season begins today only at MyBookie. And remember, use the promo code BASEBALLAMERICA to double your first deposit. Today on the Baseball America College podcast, we are very happy to be joined by Long Beach State coach Eric Valenzuela, the Dirtbags, coming off of an impressive shortened 2020 season, one of the surprise teams in the country, off to a sensational start before that season got canceled in Coach Valenzuela's first year. Coach, let's just start there with the way 2020 was going for you guys. You know, did you what was clicking for the Dirtbags?
Yeah, no, hey, thank you guys for having me. I'm pumped to be here. Yeah, you know what? Obviously, a lot of emotion is going into this 2020 season. I mean, it's our first, you know, coming from St. Mary's College, which was awesome, a great experience for my staff and I to come into this program with so much history, tradition, you know, so many great players, great teams, great coaches. You know, there's an expectation, you know, that surrounds this program for sure, and the history of it. So coming in, you know, I know that the past couple of years before had been tough. You know, we were coming in to, you know, to share, you know, what we do and how we do it. And hey, it was great. I mean, the fan support was unbelievable. You know, when we got here, the players took us in. They were great. And it was just, you know, it was a good start. I mean, we had a long ways to go. We started the season off with playing an unbelievable schedule. And, you know, it was just a glimpse into hopefully what the, you know, the expectation and the demands are of this program. And so, you know, it ended. It was short. But I think in that short amount of time, there was definitely a standard that was set from our older guys to our younger guys and beyond that with this new recruiting class that's in.
Coming into the season, you know, in preseason practices in January and February, did you get the sense that those guys were ready to go from the get-go, that this might be something special, or did that just kind of build over time as the games began?
I think what's good, you know, about, you know, change is never easy, right? When there's a new coaching staff coming in, you know, you think about the players and you think about, you know, them mentally, you know, so it's never easy. But I think what was best for it is some of these guys kind of needed a fresh start. And the good thing is we came in, you know, I mean, obviously we did homework on our roster and the guys that were coming back, but I mean, it was a clean slate. It was like, hey, you know, we're all here. You know, none of these, we haven't coached you. You know, you could have been the starting shortstop or you could have been on the bench and never played in it, and you guys are the same. I mean, we're just going to go into this with a blind eye and we're going to work hard and grind it. And really quickly, we found out that, I mean, the previous coaching staff did such a great job of recruiting these guys, man. I mean, these guys were very talented, you know, physical, fast, you know, very good on the mound. And so, you know, from an ability standpoint, they did a phenomenal job of that. And we just, you know, we just did our thing. I mean, we felt like, you know, I think what first and foremost had to come in was them to trust us, you know, that we understand that during this transition time, it's going to be tough, but, you know, to buy in and we're going to come together and just let their talent play. So, you know, I felt like definitely wasn't a talent. I felt like, man, we're very talented. We just got to put this thing together and these guys got to pick up some things really fast. I think, you know, when you're in a program and, you know, at St. Mary's, we were there for 6 years. I mean, once you get past that first or second year, everything kind of rolls, right? When you're talking about, you know, team defense stuff and signs and you're just your culture, you know, it's really easy to just kind of bring in the new freshmen and JC transfers in and just kind of teach them the ropes because everything just kind of flows. But when you're turning, you know, when you come into a new program and you have to start from scratch and put everything in, you know, it's difficult. But again, it was very exciting for us and to do it with such a phenomenal group of older guys and very talented, you know, new recruits. It was a lot of fun.
Aside from just the results on the field, I'm curious what you and your staff learned in your first year, either about yourselves as coaches or about what it's going to take to win at a high level at Long Beach that you might not have known necessarily going into the job.
Well, you know, I always felt like no matter where we are, we kind of do it in a way where we're coaching these guys from the ground up, meaning, you know, we're assuming that they know nothing, you know, and we really have to focus on developing these guys. I mean, you can have some really talented players, but they don't play the game correctly and you don't guide them and coach them up, I mean, it doesn't matter how talented you are, And so when we were at St. Mary's and at the previous places that I've been at, I mean, yes, we had very, very talented players at the top, but you know, a lot of guys were, you know, especially at St. Mary's, some guys were overlooked in the recruiting process. Some guys were, you know, we may have been the only program that was recruiting them. So we took a lot of pride in the development of our players and playing good baseball. You know, we had to. Yes, we had some talented guys. I mean, you're looking at, you know, the postseason with Tony Gonsolin and Corbin Burns. So we had some really talented players at St. Mary's, but you really had to coach up, you know, the second half of guys and make them into really good baseball players and play together as a team. And I felt like, man, if we can just, you know, if we can do, we're going to do the same thing here with just a number of talented players and get them to play the game the right way, play hard, play like dirtbags, you know. That's what we were excited about coming in here, just the amount of talent. And obviously the amount of talent that we can get and recruit moving forward has just been, super exciting. And I know we're in tough times right now, but I can't wait to get back on the field with these guys and get it going again.
You know, going to Long Beach, the Dirtbags, you know, they're just, it's such an iconic baseball brand, you know, especially for anyone in Southern California where you grew up. So what kind of was your experience with Long Beach, you know, when you were growing up around the game? Obviously you end up at Pepperdine, but you know, how much did that aura or that brand, you know, what resonated with you about Long Beach and the Dirtbags, both of that era, and then as you, you know, continued with your career and got into coaching, and then we saw some of the other stars like a Tulowitzki or a Longoria come through there.
Yeah, I mean, being born and raised in Southern California and in the San Gabriel Valley, you know, it's obviously Long Beach State is just one of those story programs. You know, the Omaha trips and just amount of major leaguers and great teams and great coaches. That's always it's a destination for a stud Southern California player. And so when you know this opportunity came up, I mean, you can't be. I mean, there's not a lot of places like it on the West Coast that has a following. And that's one of the things that we saw, you know, immediately was how much passion, you know, not only the alums and, you know, the previous teams and coaches, but just this whole community, how much passion they have. I mean, Long Beach is like, I mean, it's like a state in its own, you know. I mean, it's and they have so much expectations when you come in this program and you're coaching it and you're playing here that, you know, that is high. And you know, we're definitely, we're definitely up for the challenge and just as a young kid, you see this program, you know, there's a sense of toughness, there's a sense of great ball, fans are playing a beautiful facility. You know, it's a great school. It's a great location. All of those things come into play. And as a coach, I'm just blessed to be here and blessed for this opportunity.
You mentioned, being excited for you to get into practice and then the 2021 season coming along. You've got a couple key pieces from last year's team gone now. Adam Semenaris, LJ Jones, we're both getting their opportunities in pro ball now. But what has you most excited to get back in 2021? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I think the excitement is that, you know, what we were able to do in such a short time, you know, our guys felt like, and seriously, we felt like we hadn't even hit our stride yet. I felt like we played good baseball, but we could have played a lot better, I think, as a team in whole, pitching wise, offensively, defensively. So I think there's a lot of excitement from the older guys or the returners coming in that want more of that. And then from the young guys, I think just in that short amount of time, those 15 games, I think there was, you know, when you're a young guy, a new guy in this program and you see what happened previous, there's an expectation, not that there wasn't before, but now you're walking into a place that it's a top 25 program. And now it's like, this is the real deal. And so that's what's exciting about it. We have some great, great pieces of returners coming back. You know, I feel really good all the way around. I think the problem, and it's a good problem to have, is, you know, our roster is big. And, you know, and so it's going to be my job and our job as coaches to manage it correctly and to get everybody involved and keep everybody involved. So that's going to be the challenge. We do have a lot of talented players, and it's just going to be our job to kind of to manage it right.
Blair Field is one of the iconic baseball venues, especially out on the West Coast. It is also, you know, one of the bigger pitcher parks in the country. Does that factor into the way you want to play or the kinds of players you recruit at all? Is that a consideration at all, or do you guys kind of just, you know, work with whatever the dimensions you have out there?
Well, that's a great question, and you know, we've really, when we got here, we really had to kind of think about how we were going to go about this. I mean, obviously you're recruiting, I mean, a lot of people want to come to school here, especially on the West Coast. I mean, it's a great place to go to school, like I said, and play baseball. You know, I think from a pitching standpoint, we've always recruited the same type of guy that's going to fill up the strike zone. I mean, I think that's first and foremost. You know, I always, you know, it's a guy that can command the zone, way more than any than stuff. I mean, now obviously we want a guy that can command the zone and have, you know, legit stuff. But that plays everywhere, but especially here, right? I mean, you're pitching in a ballpark that's huge. You know, you can throw 98 miles an hour if you're not throwing strikes and you're walking guys and getting behind guys. I mean, that's not going to help in a big park. So strike throwers are key. You know, from an offensive side of things, you know, I love it because, you know, Coach Brian Peters, I mean, he is the best, you know, offensive coach in the country. And I'm not going to say gorilla ball, but it is swinging. It is playing for big innings. It's driving balls in the gaps and over the fence. And, you know, when you're out there and you're talking to recruits about Blair Field, you know, you're going to get, you know, other coaches, or you're going to get other people talking about, wow, man, it's not an offensive park. And I mean, you look at the big leaguers that have been out of here. I mean, those a lot of them are offensive guys. If you can hit here, you can hit anywhere. And again, from an offensive side of things, I mean, we're looking for guys that are physical, guys that want the challenge of playing in this ballpark. And so has it changed? I mean, you know, Coach Peters, you know, likes a certain offensive guy, you know, that could do some things, being physical, being fast. And then from a pitching standpoint, you know, and obviously defensive standpoint, me as the head coach, but also doing the pitching 100%. You know, I really want to be good defensively, and pitchers have to throw strikes. I mean, that's the command issue. The command part of it is the biggest thing for me.
I wanted to ask you a quick question about scheduling. And I guess I'll first say, let's throw out just the whole idea that we're not sure exactly what, you know, 2021 is going to look like from a scheduling standpoint. Let's just talk about kind of a typical year. One of the philosophies that you see a lot, not just at places like Long Beach, but just generally on the West Coast, is an attitude of playing a difficult schedule and trying to challenge your team out of conference. I'm curious what your philosophy just generally is. I know at St. Mary's you've had good schedules last year, obviously tough schedule with a series against Mississippi State and non-conference, but what are you and your staff looking to do with your schedule every year?
Well, I think it changes from year to year. You know, we definitely want to play just like everybody else. I think we want to play the best of the best. I think, you know, we had challenges at St. Mary's just because, you know, obviously if we wanted to play, you know, the Power Five schools or whatever, most of the time, almost 100% of the time, we had to get on the road and do that. And that was fine. But, you know, those are tough environments to play in. And we enjoyed it. But you got to be smart as well. I mean, you got to make sure that you understand what team you have. If it's a young team, if it's an older team, I mean, you got to be strategic about it. Obviously, you're scheduling for the RPI, you're scheduling for, you know, I mean, all of these things. And so I look at it from year to year and kind of just see how we're set up. Not to say that we're not going to challenge ourselves when we're young and whatever, but just to be strategic, you know, as well as, you know, really challenging on the West Coast with the RPI thing and kind of seeing, you know, I mean, common opponents and all of these type of factors that come into play, it's challenging. But this place, you know, I mean, we're expected to have an unbelievable schedule. I mean, SEC, ACC, Pac-12, big time programs going there, getting them back at Blair. So those things will never change. It's just going to be, it's just a matter of scheduling smart and challenging our players and getting them ready for, you know, obviously the unbelievable Big West Conference. And so, again, there's definitely, like I said, the expectation is huge. You play the best of the best. This is, I feel, you know, the Big West is a Power Five baseball conference, and that's what's expected. So, it's been a lot of fun. I mean, to play Wake Forest and Mississippi State, I mean, is awesome. You know, Cal and Washington, I mean, it's been a lot of fun for sure.
You mentioned St. Mary's, where you were previously, and while you were there, you had Corbin Burnes and Tony Gonsolin. Of course, Burnes got hurt and wasn't able to pitch in the playoffs, but those guys both played big parts on playoff teams. Burnes is probably going to factor in the NL Cy Young Award debate, and Gonsolin is up there in the Rookie of the Year debate. Just what was it like watching those two guys this year have the success they had on the biggest stage?
I mean, it is so fun. I'm so proud of those guys. I text those guys all the time. And I mean, it brings tears to my eyes just to really see how far those guys have come along. I mean, I remember them, you know, early in their college career and how many, you know, obstacles that they had to overcome and we all had to overcome. I mean, those guys, and I say this to them and I say this to those other guys that were there during those times. I mean, those guys put St. Mary's baseball on the map. They really did. And I can't thank those guys enough for all their, everything that they've done and, you know, not only coaching them, but the friendship that we have, you know, beyond that as well. And again, it was so much fun watching them pitch all year long. It's so much fun to communicate with them even to this, you know, to this day and during playoffs and stuff. So again, I'm a proud coach. I feel like, you know, these guys are my sons, you know, and because it's not just about the baseball part of it. I mean, we've been through a lot, you know, from a different kind of role as well, being in the classroom and off the field and those type of things. And so just to see them grow up as men and just be able to pitch at the highest level that we all, you know, that all these guys dream about being, it's been so, so great.
Gonsolin's kind of an interesting case, right? I mean, he comes to you and, you know, at least especially early on is more of a contributor as a hitter than he is on the mound. And he continued to be an effective two-way guy, but the pitching piece later in his career really started to take off. And I imagine has to be a particular point of pride of yours to see the way he's kind of developed. And now, you know, I don't know if you thought he had this in him to become what he has become, but I'm certainly, it seems like he's come a long way from being the guy that was a little more hitter than pitcher when he arrived at St. Mary's.
Well, they both had different paths. That's for sure. I mean, when we got here, you know, Corbin, you know, an undrafted, low scholarship, you know, type of player from Bakersfield, who had a big arm, but it was really raw. And it just, you know, it took time for him. I mean, I think he had like almost a 7 ERA as a freshman. You know, we sent him out to the Hamptons after his freshman year in the summer. He comes back, he's confident. He has a good sophomore year and then goes to the Cape. He goes to the Cape because we had a kid named Cameron Neff, who was supposed to go to the Cape in Orleans, but he had pitched a lot of innings and we shut him down and they took Corbin instead. And he goes out there and he deals. And then obviously here he is. Tony was a different path. We came in and I mean, we didn't even know he pitched. I mean, he was an outfielder and we were really thin the first year we got here or got to St. Mary's, really thin on the mound. And he had said, you know, he pitched in high school, we put him on the mound and he had electric stuff. It was just raw. It was an outfielder that was pitching, you know, but I think that helped him as well because I believe that these two-way guys sometimes, I mean, when pitching is like their fun portion of baseball, they go out there with no pressure and they have fun and they pitch with a different mentality, you know? And so till the last day, I mean, till draft day for Tony, I mean, he was convinced that he was going to get drafted as an outfielder. And I was telling him, man, your stuff is really good on the mound. I'm saying that you're going to be a pitcher. And he said, coach, no, I'm a major league outfielder. I said, okay, the Dodgers draft him. And sure enough, as a pitcher. And I mean, now look at him, you know, and he also can hit too. I mean, I'm hoping that they don't change that DH rule for everybody because he can really hit as well.
I mean, I'm sure he's excited about that too. If there's one thing I know about pitchers, who they all think they can hit, and he is one who can actually hit. But even if they can, all pitchers think they can.
Well, let's not forget the first game of our 2016 regional. We were at the North Carolina State Regional, and we faced Coastal Carolina, who ended up winning the World Series that year. Corbin's on the mound, and the first run of the game in the first inning with two outs, the three hole hitter up is Tony Gonsolin. He hits a home run. We go up 1-0 against Coastal. So that's a pretty pretty crazy story. You know, we ended up losing that game. It was a war. It was a great game. We lose that game. And then obviously Coastal has that unbelievable run to win the College World Series.
You know, growing up where you grew up, I'm sure you were a Dodgers fan. Does that make that, you know, any more special now that you see what he can do for the hometown team of yours?
Absolutely. I mean, I have to be good though, because remember the Angels were at the long Blair Field was yes, the alternate yes. site, you know. So we've built a really good relationship with the Angels and their whole organization. But yeah, I mean, growing up as a Dodger fan, but you know what? I mean, all these coaches would say the same thing. I mean, whatever, if you coach these guys in college and you have relationships, I'm a Brewer fan. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm a Seattle Mariner fan with Ty France, you know, who was able to Padre fan with Greg Allen, you know, I mean, it's they're like your sons. I mean, that's how we've always had relationships with our players like that. And so, yes, but I mean, Dodgers are born and raised Dodger fan, and to have Tony wear that Dodgers logo across his chest is pretty cool.
You, your dad is a boxing coach there in the area as well. And so I'm curious, what are the crossovers between boxing and baseball? Are you able to, you know, given your background, are you able to draw on anything from boxing?
100%. I think, you know, I mention him a lot because he's a coach and he's done it forever. It's a different type of coaching that he does. I mean, he's saving lives. I mean, he's getting kids off the street that he's taking them away from, you know, prison and you know, even worse than that. And so, you know, I use a lot of his teachings and his mentality to our players. I always have. And I just think it brings a different type of toughness. I think it's at times what separates us from others. And that's what we're always trying to look for, I think, as coaches, is how are we going to be different than anywhere? How are we going to be different than Fullerton? How are we going to be different than USC, UCLA? I mean, and so that's what I think as coaches, what you're always trying to do. And I think this is where we're different. I think we've, you know, with this mentality that we have, you know, this boxing kind of Tyson mentality, as we call it, I think it's different, you know, than anybody else. And I think where they kind of gel a little bit is, you know, I explained to my guys that, you know, it's the preparation of it. You know, I talk about baseball and being prepared. We have to prepare like boxers. I mean, when it's all said and done, if you're not prepared in boxing, I mean, it can cause pain. It can cause physical pain if you're not prepared. When it comes to baseball, we have to have that same mentality, you know, from an individual standpoint and as a team. And just the fact that, you know, I've been able to take my team to my dad's gym and work out and go through some team bonding, stuff like that has been awesome. And I think they love it. I mean, they love it. They're all about it. We talk a lot about, you know, I show them clips about, you know, boxing clips about comebacks and about, you know, just that mentality and their body language and how they train and all of those things come into play. And I feel like that's our difference. I feel like that's if that's expected, you know, from your team, and it's expected and it's coming out of your coach's mouth over and over again, that is definitely going to translate to the baseball field. We are going to be tough. We are going to play hard. We're going to play with a little chip on our shoulder, and we're going to be mean. And I think that's mentality. And that's the mentality that is bred when you're a dirtbag as well, you know. And I think that's where it's a good fit. You know, I feel like, you know, the history and tradition of this program is built on that. And we want to help take it to the next level. I mean, that's what we're here to do. And again, yes, I love the man. He's a mean old man, but he's you know, he's my mentor. He's my everything. And it's been he's really helped me become the coach that I am, for sure.
You know, I'll make a little bit of an assumption here that with your dad being a boxing coach, you've seen, you know, you've seen a boxing match or two in your life. Now, I'll put you on the spot a little bit and ask for a little bit of a comp. You know, there's the dirtbag style of baseball, and that obviously is a very a famous brand, like we talked about earlier. Is there someone in the, you know, famous or otherwise, someone in the world of boxing that you recall watching that you think is a dirtbag in that same way, however you define that in the boxing ring? I'd be curious if there's a boxer out there that you think could step on the baseball field and bring that type of mentality, but just in the ring.
Well, I think that's an awesome question. I mean, my favorite boxer of all time is Marvelous Marvin Hagler. And even to the point where I have a boxer dog who's 18 months and his name is Hagler. But I mean, I show him a lot of clips. You know, I show him Diego Corrales, who's a boxer. He actually passed away in a motorcycle accident, but you talk about a warrior. You talk about a guy who, I mean, there's a clip if you go on YouTube and you watch the 10th round of Diego Corrales Jose Luis Castillo, there's a 10th round where where Diego Corrales gets knocked down twice and he's out. And then he lands a left hook and buckles him and then comes in and ends up stopping him with about 30 seconds left. And I mean, I show that clip every single year to my guys, just never quit, never give up, keep punching. That's my favorite clip on YouTube, is that one for sure. But I mean, we have things like, we call it Tyson mentality. I don't know if you've seen the back of our helmets, but I give these guys, you know, I mean, you look at Ohio State football and Michigan, they have all those stickers on their helmets. We give out stickers that have a Mike Tyson face on it with his tattoo face on there. And that is our stickers that we call Tyson mentality. So, you know, Coach Peters, we have all these different, you know, offensive categories that, you know, two out RBI hit, you know, all these different kind of categories that we have that you earn these stickers and you put them on your helmet and it's a picture of Mike Tyson. It's not like a symbol of the college, you know, that other programs have. It's a Mike Tyson face. So again, you know, I don't know. It's just something that we do. It's something that we enjoy. It's something that the boys love and that makes them feel a little bit different than others.
How far did you take boxing? Was there ever a time where you thought you were going to do that and not baseball?
I did. And to this day, it's my favorite sport. I mean, I hate to say that being the baseball coach, but you know, as a young guy, always being at the gym with my dad and even to this day, my sons, you know, we have a slight gym in our garage, you know, that I work out my boys. I have twins that are 10 years old and we work out all the time. That it's my love. I mean, it's just like anything. I'm a baseball coach and my twin boys, they love baseball, right? I mean, their dad is a coach and they come with me to the field and, you know, I help them. We work out all the time. So it's the same thing. I mean, I was at the gym since I could, when I was a baby, you know, being around my dad and, you know, he was so good at his job. I mean, even to this day, he's had world champions. He was, you know, an assistant, you know, in the 84 Olympics, you know, and so, you know, he's done the amateur thing. He's had amateurs, he's had pros, you know, and just being able to be there and train and be with him. I mean, he wanted something different for me. You know, I think in his eyes, you know, boxing was it was kids that were, he was saving, getting off the streets and having them, you know, teaching them discipline and teaching them, you know, responsibility. With me, I mean, his ultimate goal was, you know, for me to go to college, you know, and there was no baseball in my background at all. And just happened to, you know, I mean, at some point be a pretty good baseball player, but boxing was, I mean, that was always my love, man. That was it. And even to this day, it's my love and I love it. And it just, that's my hobby, you know, golf for people, you know, different hobbies. Me, it's boxing for sure.
We'll wrap up here with what Teddy has described as the most important question we've been asking all of our guests, probably the last five or six we've had on. So we'll pose it to you. Describe to us your favorite sandwich.
Ooh. Pastrami sandwich from The Hat is my favorite. You ever heard of The Hat?
No, I haven't actually. Is that out there?
Yeah, Southern California. I don't know if it goes beyond Southern California or maybe the state of California in whole, but it's called The Hat. So next time you're at Blair Field watching the Dirtbags, we're going to get you a pastrami sandwich from The Hat.
That sounds like a plan. I'm down for. I like sandwiches that are kind of in that that Italian mold, you know, with things like pastrami and salami, yeah, and things like that. It's a little heavier sandwich, but it's not. It's good.
I was just going to say that it's not healthy one bit. It is very. I mean, you think sandwich, you're thinking like tuna, healthy, you know. No. Pastrami sandwich. Yeah, you won't be hungry for a month.
Yeah, it'll be well worth it though in the end.
For sure.
Like Joe said, that is that's as important as we get here. You know, we talk a lot about baseball, but when it comes right down to it, the sandwiches, that's what we really want to hear about.
That's awesome, guys.
Well, Coach, we really appreciate you taking the time today. You know, we're excited to see what the Dirtbags look like in 2021. It was such a great start to 2020. I wish we could have seen it finish, but we'll be excited to follow along next spring when you guys are back out on the diamond.
For sure. Yep. And I know it's been a challenge for everybody. And you know, I mean, some schools are starting and some schools aren't. And, you know, it's going to be a challenging 2021. But like I told my players, I mean, this is great. And let's make it a great story in the end. You know, we haven't been able to do anything, you know, on the field. And we may not be able to do anything on the field till January and when other teams are. And let's just make it a great story. Let's think back to the time when we weren't doing anything and others were. And we're going to find a way to be successful and win. So we're excited. And I appreciate you guys having me.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks again to Long Beach State coach Eric Valenzuela for joining us here on the Baseball America College podcast. Joe, really interesting stuff all around. There's a lot of directions we could go in. There's Long Beach State stuff. There's the pro ball stuff. There's the boxing stuff. So I'll let you take it where you want to take it as, from what Eric said during that interview.
Yeah, I think it certainly hammers home the fact that, if you're someone out there, if you're, maybe an umpire, like in some sort of argument, if you're a player who's feeling himself, like you don't want to step to Eric Valenzuela, man. Guy has a boxing gym in his house, grew up in a boxing family. That's not a guy you want to step to because his hands are going to be quicker than yours. That's just the way that works. His hands are going to be quicker. But I joke, of course, because I mean this sincerely, one of the nicest guys in the game, one of the most fun guys to talk to. Always enjoy chatting with him. He's just got a good attitude and he has a good sense of humor and really is willing to we're a podcast that kind of veers from side to side on topics sometimes, and you know, he's the type of guy who's really willing to go with that. So it was cool to do that with him. I'm excited about what we saw with Long Beach in 2020. I'm excited obviously to see it again in 2021 potentially, but I think just generally I'm really excited about the idea of Long Beach getting back to a place where it's been in the past. We've seen little windows of it. You know, obviously there was 2017 where they were just one win away from getting back to Omaha, and talk about things that seem like so long ago when you consider so much has happened in the Long Beach program since then. But wasn't that long ago, but that was just a little window. But getting back to a place where Long Beach is a consistent contender in the Big West and nationally year after year, I think would be, it's a little bit of an overused phrase, like, you know, college baseball or enter whatever sport here is better when X team is good. And I think sometimes that gets overplayed, but for me personally, I think college baseball is better when Long Beach State is good. And I think part of that is it gives Fullerton a foil in the Big West, which I think is good for Fullerton to have a foil in the Big West. I also think it makes the West Coast a little more competitive and put some good teams outside of just the Pac-12 plus Fullerton. So I think there's that as well. And look, I mean, you talked about it a little bit with him. You asked him the question about the iconic Long Beach brand. And we've talked about this before on the podcast, but it really is just on the, you know, on the short list of just the coolest college baseball brands. I did not grow up in Southern California. I grew up halfway across the country, and I had friends who, you know, my friend group was pretty into college baseball. That's how I started with this. And yes, there were a lot of UT hats and A&M hats, and at that time in particular, a lot of Rice hats. But beyond that, there might have been more Long Beach hats than anything else. You know, it was just a cool hat to have. The LB, the interlocking LB is just an iconic symbol in college baseball. And so there's just something about Long Beach being good that's, for me, more exciting about college baseball. And it's just cool to have Long Beach be good. And some of that is nostalgia, sure. I'll grant you that for me personally. But I do believe that it is better for the West Coast and college baseball in general if we have Long Beach really humming and clicking on all cylinders. And at least with what we saw in 2020, seems like maybe it's heading that way under Valenzuela.
Yeah, I don't think there's any need to downplay that. In this case, I think it's dead on. College baseball is better with a good Long Beach. And if you want evidence of that, just look at the 2017 Super Regional that they hosted against Fullerton. Now, I mean, obviously that's a huge rivalry, just their regular season home and aways are really good series, but you know, they absolutely packed out Blair. I remember the ESPN cameras love showing this guy that like had brought a ladder so that he could like get a better vantage point from somewhere up one of the baselines. Like that looked like an absolutely great time for a college baseball game. And, you know, so if the game can get more weekends like that, you know, obviously that's just good for everyone involved. It's, you know, best for the Dirtbags and their fans, but if you can have that kind of thing going on, I don't care what part of the country it is, you know, that's, you want those programs to be as engaged as possible. And then when you, you know, add in the history that Long Beach provides, when you think about the big leaguers that have come through there, the fact that they play at Blair Field, this, again, the, you know, one of the iconic college baseball stadiums, it really becomes a much bigger thing that program be able to come out and compete at as high a level as they possibly can. And, you know, Joe's went pretty deep into the Big West and why the Big West hasn't been quite as good the last few years, and like what's it going to take for them to come back and all the rest of that, and ignoring what this might or might not mean for the Big West, just it would be great to get that kind of excitement around the program on a much more consistent basis than what we've seen it for the last 15 or so years.
Yeah, I don't. So this, what I'm about to say is not to disparage, certainly not to disparage UCLA, because I think you'll find no greater advocate for John Savage and what he has done with that program, and just year after year after year after year losing guys, but just continuing to plug guys in, and it seems like they really do just reload. So they are operating on a higher level than any other program on the West Coast, save I guess Oregon State. Well, that's like a different discussion because they are way up in the Pacific Northwest. But so I don't know exactly what I mean by this, but to me, Long Beach and Fullerton, when those programs are good and when that rivalry is really hot, that's kind of the heart and soul of West Coast baseball to me. And I don't know what I mean by that, but I feel that, and I believe that. And some of it I think is there's not a lot of glamour, even though it is Southern California, there's not a lot of glamour there. Blair Field is a historic facility. That does not mean it's the most plush facility. It's kind of the same thing at Goodwin at Fullerton. These are not SEC level palaces in college baseball. They typically recruit hyper locally with guys who aren't necessarily the big name guys out on the West Coast. They're developing guys. They have a specific type of player. I think that all goes into it, but I think that is kind of the heart and soul of West Coast college baseball. Those two programs going at it like they do and both being good and competing to go to Omaha.
Yeah, I'm like, I get where you're coming from. I don't know that I would use those exact words, but the rivalry that exists out there is a fantastic one. And, you know, to see what, you know, Long Beach State can become under Eric Valenzuela, who took a program at St. Mary's that was, I mean, to say it was an afterthought would be maybe overstating how good it was. You know, they'd never been to the NCAA tournament, and, you know, he made them very much relevant within the West Coast Conference, took them to the NCAA tournament, and, you know, produced, you know, some big league stars just in a few short years there. To have that, you know, the energy that created that now coming down to Long Beach, it has the potential to really you know, become something special there. And so I'm very interested to see where that goes. I'm also struck by, you know, what he was saying just about the time that they had at St. Mary's with some of those guys. I mean, you think about what they had there in Burns and Gonzalez, and you know, they really had some special teams there that, you know, it's just remarkable to look up and see an NL Cy Young award debate that's going to include Corbin Burns. It's probably going to be Trevor Bauer's award, but, you know, look for Corbin Burns to get a lot of votes. And, you know, we'll see how the NL Rookie of the Year shakes out. That's a very complex award this year, but, you know, Gonsolin's going to be a big part of that. And, you know, he's become a pretty important piece for the Dodgers. And, it's just interesting to hear. I'm not surprised to hear, but that right up until the very end, you know, he thought he was going to be a big league outfielder, and now he's found his home on the mound.
Yeah, I found that story kind of funny too. It's kind of, you know, it kind of speaks to, you know, maybe it shows that, you know, sometimes what a player is best equipped to do at the next level is not necessarily what they want to do. And I don't know if that was really the case with him necessarily, but it does sound a little bit like Gonsolin was like, nah, I'd really just like to hit. And so for his sake, I don't, you know, for me personally, I'm okay with the DH in both leagues, but for his sake, you know what? I hope he gets to continue to hit, because if he wanted to hit that bad in the big leagues, I certainly hope he gets that chance. And you know, we are in a little bit of a glory age for two-way players, the big league level. So, you know, maybe there is an opportunity for him to do a little bit of that, but yeah, cool story. And those are the types of things that they did at St. Mary's. You're right. I mean, afterthought is probably giving them too much credit before Eric Valenzuela got there. And I think if you're really looking for evidence of what they can build there, there are some times where you will get a coaching staff at a small school that program gets hot very quickly, and then they're out. You know, they're there a couple of years. They have this big success with the first group of players that comes through. And then, you know, they're on to the next job. And I don't begrudge them that. But you just still are left with questions about, okay, how sustainable is what you're doing here? You know, Valenzuela was and his staff at St. Mary's for a good long while. And, you know, once they got good, they stayed good. You know, the first year there was tough, but they finished over 500 every other year after that. 28 wins, 33, 37, 31, 35 wins. I mean, those are good teams year after year. So they clearly had put something into place that was repeatable year after year. And I think that really does bode well for what they can do at Long Beach now, because this was not a case of a coaching staff coming in, having success right away, which they did, by the way, but then they didn't really necessarily just strike when the iron was hot and bounce. They stuck around and really built something there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he's got a chance to make Long Beach State into a very good program. You know, just raise it back to the level that I think a lot of people are accustomed to the Dirtbags being. And it's not going to be an easy climb. There are a lot of reasons why Long Beach State has not been able to find some of that consistent success over the last decade. But I think there's a lot of reason to think right now that it could. And when you just then think about a potential Big West race of, you know, Long Beach State, Santa Barbara, Fullerton, Cal Poly, you know, that gets pretty exciting about what that kind of race could look like if all four of those schools are able to click, or even another school joining that group, whether that's a Northridge or Hawaii or whoever. You know, that there's a lot to like about what that, just the excitement that a Big West race involving those kinds of teams at the top of the standings, what that could mean.
Yeah, here. I'm certainly here for a competitive top to bottom Big West, and I think you know, small samples with some of these guys who haven't been in these coaching positions long, but it seems like we're trending in that direction.
All right, so we mentioned it on the in the interview there, and before that, the Major League Baseball playoffs began last week with the wild card round, and as we always do, we went through the rosters for all the playoff teams and totaled up which college programs had produced the most players on MLB active playoff rosters. That's something you only can find at Baseball America. Other places will talk about who has the most players on playoff teams, but that does not actually mean on playoff rosters. It just means like on 40-man rosters. So anyway, if you want to see who's actually playing in the playoffs, you have to come check out our list. And the answer this year, for the first time in a couple of years, it had been Fullerton the last 2 years at least. But this year it is Vanderbilt, and they had 7 players active on playoff rosters. And it's a pretty impressive group overall. You know, right now Vanderbilt has, you know, some of the most they're close to the top of the list of just the most big leaguers. So it kind of stands to reason that then they would be at the top of this list as well. But you know, you start looking at some of the names, and it's like Walker Buehler and Tony Kemp and Sonny Gray and it's like really impactful players within Vanderbilt history. And now many of them are having really impactful times in the big leagues, probably none more so than Walker Buehler, who is scheduled to be the game one starter for the Dodgers in the division series. Just another impressive moment for the Vanderbilt program, I suppose.
No doubt about that. Yeah, and it's a list of guys that strikes me as a group. Not all. I mean, there are some guys on the list for them who were in the program a generation prior, if you will, put it that way. But for the most part, it's a group of guys that I kind of think of as the guys who were starting to really come along and come in waves that culminated in Vanderbilt winning a national title in 2014, where you were starting to, you know, they were really, you know, in the immediate aftermath of that, by the way, but they had really got to that point, and the program has been cooking for a good long while now, but it really got to a different level when it started to churn through. There was always some first round arm at the front of the rotation that has kind of continued to now where they've got, oh, perhaps two of them. But the guys who were on this list kind of struck me as those types of guys, or a guy like, you know, Tony Kemp, who is just a spark plug of a player whose numbers don't necessarily tell the whole story of what all he brought to that Vanderbilt program. I think Tim Corbin would tell you that. I think his teammates would tell you that. Now, he did also win the SEC Player of the Year, which I had forgotten until you reminded me of that. I would not have pegged Tony Kemp as an SEC Player of the Year guy, but sure enough, 2013, he was that guy. So, it was not a surprise to see Vanderbilt be on top of that list, especially when you start to look at, you know, the types of guys they have in this position, in particular, the pitchers who factor prominently in that group. And then when we rank them for what came out this Monday, those guys are near the top of the list of ranking the guys who are involved in the division series who are college stars.
Yeah, so let's kind of transition to that list. We went through and we had this idea of like, okay, we know which programs produce the most talent, but who are the most talented individuals? And initially, I think Joe and I kind of set out to include all players from playoff rosters. And then we kind of realized that like, oh, the division series start on the day we're planning on releasing this list. Let's just actually focus on those players. So thereby we eliminated like three players of the year from the list, Trevor Bauer among them. Matt Wieters is not a player of the year. I don't have the list up in front of me if you couldn't tell, but you know, those two guys, I remember, you know, move out of the list. So we're still left with a really solid group, topped by Mike Zunino, who won the player of the year. You got guys like Swanson and Bregman and George Springer. And, you know, it's an interesting list to look at just when you consider the amount of talent that is still playing in the postseason, that's playing on the biggest stage, having, you know, big moments on the biggest stage, and, you know, what they were able to accomplish in college, just to look back at some of the highlights of that and what some of these players were able to do. I don't know. I found it to be an interesting exercise. I know Joe actually did most of the hard work in looking up statistics and the like, but it, you know, just being able to read through it is, you know, it's a trip down memory lane for a lot of these guys, but it's also just a reminder of how good a lot of these players are in college baseball and then continue to be once they reach the big leagues.
Yeah, I had fun putting this together for a number of different reasons, and it's really not necessarily for the guys at the top of this list. It's like, yeah, okay, yeah, we remember Mike Zunino was great. Bregman, yep, sure. Swanson, Springer, yep. But it's kind of the surprise. There were two things. The surprises of the guys that were higher on this list, and if you had just asked me roughly before I started this exercise, where in the top 25 would you have put this guy? There were a couple that stood out to me, one of whom was Drew Pomeranz, who comes in fifth on this list. If you'd have told me, based on his college career, he would come in ahead of two Vanderbilt guys in Kyle Wright and Walker Buehler, and Garrett Cole in particular, I don't think I would have believed you, but I had really forgotten how good Drew Pomeranz was. I mean, 344 career strikeouts and 267 and a third innings. I mean, that's a pretty absurd strikeout number there. And I did not expect we'd be looking at Drew Pomeranz in the top five, but we were. And, you know, another Mississippi guy, Jonathan Holder, in the top 10. Now, talk about dominant closers, my goodness. And he was really kind of that, you know, what the major leagues have discovered in the last several years that college teams have known for a long time, and that's that a closer doesn't have to be just the ninth inning guy. And Holder's kind of a classic example of that, where, you know, he was a multi-inning guy. Sure, he collected a ton of saves, but he was really more of a bullpen ace than he was just a strictly a closer. And those were two guys in the top 10 that I probably would not have pegged as top 10 guys.
Yeah, I would agree definitely on Holder. Pomerantz, like, I don't know where I would have placed him just mentally, but he is a guy that, you know, was a top five draft pick. So, you know, you see that and I'm like, okay, it has to have been a really good college career. But then to see exactly how good it was, you know, that's it is a very, very impressive career when you look back on it. And, you know, making this list also was, you know, you're asked to, you know, compare and contrast some different player types. You know, so Gerrit Cole, of course, now one of the best players in the big leagues, was the first overall pick, but, you know, also has some numbers that are, you know, not elite when you look at his college career. They're still very, very good, and he's very deserving of being on this list in the top 10. But, you know, you think about what Gerrit Cole has become, and it's kind of easy to forget that, you know, you think about what he's become. You consider that he was the Friday starter for UCLA for 2 years, and that includes a year that they were the national runners-up. And, you know, it would be easy to think, like, oh, well, he was – like this just incredible college pitcher, like think Steven Strasburg's junior year for like 3 years or something. And it wasn't quite like that. He needed some time to grow into who he's become. And, you know, you see some of these other guys, you know, that have bigger careers over the full 4 years. And then you look at a guy like Hunter Renfroe, who, you know, really needed the first 2 years to develop at Mississippi State before he could have the kind of breakout season that really showed how high his ceiling was. And, you know, he continues to show that in the big leagues. But just interesting to, as we kind of compared and, you know, tried to line up players like that. You know, I mean, you compare it with a guy like Tony Kemp, who was SEC Freshman of the Year and then 2 years later SEC Player of the Year, but, you know, is an atypical player himself because he didn't hit for power. You know, it's a speed average kind of player, but the credentials were very impressive throughout Tony Kemp's college career at Vanderbilt.
A couple of the other things that stood out to me as I put this list together, as I just kind of do the let's remember some guys thing here, one was Brett Gardner. And specific to Brett Gardner, because he's not that anonymous a player. He's been on the Yankees forever, and he's a well-known guy. But Matt Carpenter of the Cardinals gets held up, rightfully so, as kind of this great player development story of he was a fifth-year player at TCU, and he was a nice college player, but he was never a superstar. And then he gets into pro baseball, and he really kind of continually reinvents himself and becomes this super productive big leaguer. Well, Brett Gardner is somewhat a similar story. He was a four-year guy, not a five-year guy, but he had a slow start to his career at College of Charleston. He kind of started to put it together, and then by the time he was a senior, he hits .447 as a senior at College of Charleston. And so safe to say he really figured it out. And that was, by the way, for those who aren't well-versed in the history of it, that was a really good College of Charleston program back then. I mean, he was gone for this, but in 06, they get to a super regional. They won something like 48 and 47 games his last 2 years there. So really good player on a really good team, obviously has turned into a really good big leaguer. There were also, you mentioned Hunter Renfroe as having that one big breakout season. Arkansas pitcher Ryan Stanek was kind of the same thing, where he was a nice arm his entire career in Arkansas, but he just went nuts his junior year and had like a one, I don't have his page here in front of me, but I think it was a 1.39 ERA his junior season, which is insane. And it's kind of a weird stat line because the ERA really stands out, but his strikeout rate was good, but not great. And so perhaps a super analytically minded analyst would tell you that maybe he just had a lot of batted ball luck. But I don't know. you know, I don't remember it well enough. I remember him, but I do not remember it well enough to really know whether that was the case or not. We also weren't really thinking of things at the college level back then like that. I mean, we just looked at the ERA and said, yeah, really good, which was true, but it would have been interesting to see that season through today's lens, I guess is what I'm saying. But 1.39 ERA will play regardless. And the last guy is a guy who I will admit I had never heard of until I started doing this list, and that was Ryan Thompson, who pitches for the Rays, played for Campbell. And his numbers were really off the charts good. So he had 2 years there as a reliever. In those 2 years, he threw, in his first year, 71 2/3 innings, all out of the bullpen. His ERA was 0.88. The next year, he threw 88 innings, once again, all out of the bullpen, and he had an ERA of 1.33. And I get that, okay, it's Campbell, it's the Big South, it's not the SEC or what have you, but I don't know, man. That's a lot of innings to have ERAs that low 2 years in a row. So his career ERA is like hovering around one in roughly 160 career innings. That was just an absurd stat line for a guy that I really didn't, like I said, I really didn't know, which was a kind of a cool little byproduct of doing this list, is acquainting myself with some guys who, you know, I had never really taken the time to examine.
Campbell is becoming a very interesting player development place, what they're able to accomplish, and just also on-field success. You know, what they're able to accomplish under Greg Goff and what Justin Hare has continued there in Buies Creek. They're under the radar now. Maybe the noise they made in Greenville a couple years ago helped bring the program a little more notoriety, but they're a program to watch. And you know, as they continue to produce players like that and get them into pro ball and where they have success, you know, I think you're going to hear more and more about them and see that program continue to develop. Just an interesting program, I would say, to watch. Right now, overall, at the moment, the AL teams have updated their rosters for the division series. The NL teams have not. 148 two- or four-year colleges have at least one player who's made an active postseason roster. So pretty wide array of the number of schools that have players continuing on in pro ball, which is always, you know, again, something that I find very interesting, that you know, you can have players from, you know, the South Dakota State has had two players here on active rosters in pro ball and or in the playoffs. And you know, South Dakota State, you know, is not a school that we spend a whole lot of time talking about when we're just talking about college baseball, but you know, good baseball players come from everywhere, and you know, the scouts out there do a great job at finding these players, and you know, player development and pro ball continues to develop them. But you know, it starts in college for, you know, a lot of these guys, and or continues, it starts in high school and earlier for everyone, but college is a key point of development for a lot of these guys. And you know, I think you see some of that reflected here as you watch the playoffs. So hopefully you check out the top 25 ahead of the division series as you're watching those games from Southern California and Texas this week. All right, so that's going to do it for us today on the Baseball America College Podcast. We want to encourage you to subscribe wherever you're getting your podcast, whether that's Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Not only can you listen to us, but you know, daily throughout the postseason, we have a playoff podcast as well that you can check out. You know, get the latest on what happened the previous night around the postseason. JJ Cooper and Kyle Glazer do a great job bringing that to you. So if you're interested in that, you can find that in the Baseball America podcast feed as well. You can follow Joe and me on Twitter. I am at Ted Cahill. Joe is Joe Healy, BA. And we will be back here with another edition of the Baseball America College Podcast next week, just as we are every week throughout this long off season. Slowly approaching is the 2021 season, but we're here to keep talking college baseball throughout the off season, and we appreciate you guys joining us every week on that journey. So I want to thank you guys for listening. Thank you to MyBookie. Thank you to Rapsodo for presenting the Baseball America College podcast. And again, you can check out that Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national database. I'm Teddy. He's Joe. We'll talk to you next week on the Baseball America College podcast.